This is the Bournemouth and Wessex Talking newspaper recorded on June the 10th, 2026. Hello everyone, welcome to our latest recording. I'm Diana and I've edited this edition. Alison and Peter are reading today and John is our engineer in charge of the recording. Now this week is designated as National Bike Week in the UK. This annual event, which apparently has been going on for over 90 years, aims to showcase the benefits of cycling by encouraging people to give it a try. So John's chosen for today's recording some pieces of music which are loosely connected with bicycles and cycling, so we hope you'll enjoy them. And the piece you've just heard was part of the Push Bite song by the group Mungo Jerry. Before we start, I just want to apologise to those of you who missed out on our recording of last time. We did not receive a large majority of wallets back, for which we can only blame Royal Mail, as a large batch of wallets, more than 20, were returned together, but these were after our last recording date. We're very sorry about this, but it was out of our control. I've been to see Royal Mail sorting office to explain the situation and emphasise that our wallets, marked articles for the blind, should have priority and be delivered as first-class post. So we hope there will be no more problems, but we are keeping our eye on this. And now here is Alison to start the Wessex news.
BCP says every penny from parking fines is reinvested back into transport services. After the latest data revealed, the council collected over £2.7 million in fines last year. A Freedom of Information request also revealed that the number of fines given out increased in 2025 to 95,203, up from 94,999 in 2024. The council have said the main issue they are tackling is illegal parking and are calling on the government to give them hours to increase penalty charge notices. Councillor Richard Herod of the portfolio holder for Destination Leisure and Commercial Operations said that parking fines are not about profit. By law, every penny must be reinvested back into transport services. The real issue facing our conurbation is illegal parking. Our teams on the ground are working relentlessly to tackle this, often in challenging conditions and with limited powers. Last weekend, they issued 3,000 penalty charge notices and removed 7 vehicles from our streets and had multiple tows interrupted. The hot weather on bank holidays saw thousands flock to the beaches in Bournemouth, with some parking their cars illegally. This, according to the council, increases congestion and disruption. The highest number of parking fines came in August, when over 10,000 penalties were issued. For the second year in a row, Old Christchurch Road was the location where the most fines were given out. Other ticket hotspots include Sandbanks Car Park, St Michael's Road and Bath Road South Car Park.
Eligible people in the South West are being urged to get their spring COVID vaccine before the offer ends in less than a month. In the South West, nearly 500,000 people have received the vaccine during this campaign. But health officials are reminding eligible residents that appointments are only available until the end of June. Emma Redfern, Medical Director for Specialised Commissioning at NHS England South West, said, "You only have until June the 30th to get your spring COVID-19 vaccine. So it is important that everyone eligible comes forward as soon as possible." This is especially important for adults and children aged 6 months and over who are immunosuppressed, as COVID-19 can cause serious illness for those with a weakened immune system. The spring booster is being offered to adults aged 75 and over, including those who turn 75 by June the 30th. Residents in older adult care homes and individuals aged 6 months and over who are immunosuppressed as well. Eligible people can book an appointment through the NHS app, the NHS website, or by calling 119. More information is available at the NHS website.
Hospitality business owners have said that money from a so-called tourist tax must be reinvested back into the industry. BH Area Hospitality Association, BAHA, which represents several businesses in Bournemouth, stated that any tourism levy should be used only as additional funding and not replace existing council spending. BCP Council's renewed calls for a levy came amidst the disaster recently on Bournemouth Beach, saying the funds would help better manage seasonal pressures. Rosie Radwell, chair of BAHA and managing director of the Marsham Court Hotel, said, "We are in support of an accommodation levy, meaning our industry gets to decide how the money is spent. But we are against a tourism tax, because that's entirely different. It's a value-added tax. Let's call it what it is." In meetings, the council have admitted that the revenue from a tax would go on other things that are nothing to do with tourism. "It is not fair to charge families that are coming down, staying overnight and having a nice time. They would be punished and forced to pay for the actions of day trippers who are causing all the disruption. We are calling for a levy which is ring-fenced, giving the sector autonomy to reinvest, for example, to bring back events like the Bournemouth Air Festival." Jessica Toll, MP for Bournemouth West, said, "The overnight visitor levy represents an opportunity to secure the funds we need to manage the impacts of tourism and promote our towns as destinations. I agree with industry that we must ensure the money raised is reinvested specifically in tourism, not used to plug gaps in other areas of council spending."
A major rollout of life-saving equipment from Nationwide is underway to make high streets safer in an emergency. Defibrillators and bleed control kits are planned to be installed at all 605 Nationwide branches by the end of the year. Installations in Dorset and Hampshire will take place in Lymington on June the 15th, Broadstone on July the 3rd, and in Parkston and Winton on July the 14th. The rollout will continue across the county throughout the year and forms part of Nationwide's wider support for high streets. And this includes a pledge to keep all branches open until at least 2030. The scheme is delivered in partnership with Visa, while St John Ambulance provides emergency first aid training to Nationwide staff and members of the public.
I know we're not even halfway through June, but here's an item about Christmas. Bournemouth and Poole's new town councils will not be funding Christmas light displays this year. BCP Council withdrew direct funding for festive lights in 2023 due to budget pressures. Christmas lights are one of the services town councils can provide, but the newly established lower tier authorities in Bournemouth and Poole have said that they won't be funding Christmas lights, as no money was set aside for displays in their budgets. Councillor Mark Anderson, leader of the Bournemouth Reform Group, said, "I don't think we're going to be able to, unfortunately. The thing is, with the council, we don't want to spend anything that has not been allocated and the budget has already been set for us." Broadstone Town Council does have a line in their budget for Christmas lights totalling £3,000. Both Bournemouth and Poole business improvement districts currently fund festive lights in their respective town centres. It has previously been reported that Christchurch Town Council confirmed that they would be planning for the Christmas lights in 2026.
businesses in Bournemouth and Poole have been hit with huge fines for employing workers who did not have the legal right to work in the UK. The penalties, which together total £345,000, follow immigration enforcement activity at barbers, car wash and takeaway premises. The owner of Poole Car Wash, which was fined nearly £100,000, said it's not fair because they were unaware that two of their staff members were working illegally when the Home Office visited their premises. M&M Turkish Barber in East Howe Lane in Bournemouth was also fined £80,000.
The world in which you're living gets a bit too much to bear, and you need someone to lean on. When you look, there's no one there. You're gonna find me out in the country. You're gonna find me way out in the country.
Despite the many miles of dedicated cycle lanes which have been constructed throughout our area in recent times, the vast majority of cyclists seem to prefer to ride on country lanes. So part of In the Country, a hit record in the mid-1960s for Cliff Richard and the Shadows, opens the news from Bournemouth and Christchurch.
A school will introduce a full ban on smartphones in a bid to protect students. Twynham School in Christchurch will implement the policy this coming September. The school said smartphones were linked to distraction, social conflict, bullying and exposure to harmful content. Head of school, Kate Ball, said, "If your phone is buzzing in your bag or pocket, it's hard not to feel tempted to have a look at it or just drift off focus from what you're doing in your lesson." Twynham isn't the first school in the area to introduce a ban on smartphones. In May last year, St Peter's Catholic School banned them for its younger years and introduced tighter rules for older students over safeguarding risks to children. St Peter's introduced the new measures after a survey of parents and carers showed that 97% believe smartphones and social media pose a risk to children. Deputy head teacher James Wilder said, "At St Peter's, we firmly believe that smartphones and social media present significant safeguarding risks to children." The school banned smartphones across its primary school years from September 2025. Mobile phone policies were also tightened for students in years 8 to 13.
Bournemouth Airport is now charging more than Heathrow for short-stay pick-up and drop-off, as taxi drivers and local businesses say the increase has been introduced without warning and risks driving customers away. From June the 1st, motorists using the airport's pick-up and drop-off zone pay £8 for up to 30 minutes, up from £6 in December 2025 and £5 prior to that. Stays of between 30 and 60 minutes have doubled from £7.50 to £15, while 1 to 4 hours now cost £20. The new tariff means Bournemouth Airport is now more expensive than both Heathrow and Southampton airports for short stays, where charges are around £7. Jay Armid of Canford Taxi said drivers were caught off guard by the increase, which he claims was introduced overnight. Mr. Armid, who has worked for a taxi driver for more than 12 years, said the timing was particularly damaging as the airport enters its busiest period. "This is a season now for airport pickups. There are more airlines and more passengers. With the cost of everything, people may just stop using taxis and ask friends or family instead, or meet outside the airport, and I cannot blame them." In response, Bournemouth Airport said the increase reflects rising operating costs. "We understand that no one welcomes increased charges, but our airport group is facing sharp rises in costs, including a tripling of business rates, higher employment costs such as national insurance and rising energy costs. At the same time, we continue to invest millions of pounds in maintaining the airport infrastructure needed to provide an essential public service in our region.
A community centre in Dorset has honoured its dedicated volunteers during a special evening of thanks. The Winton Salvation Army, based on Latimer Road, hosted a celebratory dinner for its 100 volunteers on Monday, June the 1st, as the country celebrates Volunteer Week, June the 1st to June the 6th, recognising their role in delivering vital services across the area. Volunteers support a wide range of programmes, including meal services for those experiencing homelessness, social groups, children's activities, and administrative support. Among the volunteers at the Winton Salvation Army is 91-year-old Glenda, who has volunteered at the centre for more than 30 years.
A charity which has supported Ukraine with humanitarian aid throughout the 4 years of the war has won a national accolade. Ukraine Relief, based at a huge retail unit at Castle Point in Bournemouth, was set up within days of the Russian invasion in February 2022. Since then, it has delivered more than 5,250 tonnes of aid worth over £18 million, alongside 408 vehicles, including ambulances, trucks and a fire engine, to support local communities and emergency services. Deliveries have also included nearly 400 generators, hospital equipment, food, clothing and oxygen machines. Now the team has been named as Charity of the Year by defence technology firm Cohort PLC and awarded a donation of £20,000. Chief Executive of the charity, Carol Shuaki, said, "We are incredibly proud and honoured to be recognised in this way. This award is not just for our charity. It belongs to every volunteer, donor, partner, trustee and friend who has stood with us since the beginning. Together we are making a real difference in the lives of those affected by this terrible war. Together we are creating a better tomorrow." Mrs. Riaki, who is from Poland, added, "We are fighting for the future, not only of Ukraine, but of the whole free world. While humanitarian organisations like ours serve and support civilians affected by the war, companies in the defence sector, such as Cohort, help defend our future." The address for any drop-offs for the charity is Management Suite, Unit Z, East Mall, Castle Point, BH8 9UZ, or visit their website ukrainerelief.org.uk.
The council has still not found a contractor to carry out repair work to restore Bournemouth Pier, with work still expected to start this year. In March 2023, Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole Council received £20 million from the government as part of the Levelling Up Fund. Almost half of this funding, £9.6 million, has been allocated for repairing and restoring Bournemouth Pier. The work should give the pier an additional 25-year lifespan and include undertaking concrete repairs, installing compressed current cathodic protection system to prevent corrosion, and removal of all timber landing stages. Work was initially due to begin in the winter of 2024, but in early 2025, the local authority said it expected the works to begin in late 25 or early 26. In the latest update, BCP Council has said it now expects that work will begin in autumn 2026 and should be completed within 18 months.
The Regent in Christchurch has temporarily closed for annual maintenance. From Monday, June the 1st, to Sunday, June the 21st, the venue will not hold any cinema screenings or live performances as essential building work is carried out. Necessary maintenance will be performed on the stage and theatre systems. Dressing rooms and backstage areas are also set for refurbishment. The facility will have a deep clean, which includes auditorium seating and carpets. Various upgrades will also be made, such as improvements to bar tills, the box office system, and the launch of a new website. The updated online platform, along with other services, is scheduled to go live on Thursday, June the 11th at 10 a.m. Patrons should note that from June the 8th to June the 10th, the box office will be closed, phone lines disconnected, and the website offline, meaning ticket booking will not be possible during this period. For the remainder of the maintenance period, some weekday services will be operating with varied opening.
Pope Leo XIV has honoured a Boscombe resident with a special blessing in recognition of his 2 decades of volunteering. Richard Arthur received a papal blessing, which is an accolade awarded for unwavering commitment to service to their communities for over 25 years. Mr. Arthur has devoted much of his life to voluntary services to the charity CAFOD, the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. He is among a group of long-serving volunteers from across England and Wales who have been recognised for their dedication. Mr. Arthur said, "It was an honour and privilege, but in receiving it, I want to share it with all of the parish who have supported me and CAFOD in the past 25 years, and in particular, my many team members."
In order to get the power produced by the cyclist to the rear wheel of the bicycle for propulsion, one of the most important parts on the bike is the chain. So part of The Chain by Fleetwood Mac opens the news from Wimborne and North Dorset. Young Emmett Roberts, who lives near Blandford, has the dancing world at his feet. Emmett, who is 10, attends St Nicholas Primary School in Child Oakford, and he recently became 5th in his age group in the Irish Dancing World Championships in Dublin. He danced 3 rounds in the minor boys' competition, 2 in heavy shoes and 1 in light shoes, and was judged by 5 adjudicators. He took part in the Cayley team events and came 7th with the 4-hand team and 6th with the 8-hand team. Emmett, who has Irish roots, got into dancing through his mum, who enjoyed Irish dancing for many years growing up. She said Emmett loved it from the age of 4 when she took him to his first class and he showed early ability. He is part of the O'Leary Academy of Irish Dancing and attends classes in Christchurch and Ferndown. Chrissy says Irish dancing requires strength, stamina, flexibility and a positive attitude. Emmett enjoys the friendship, fitness and focus involved in the Irish dancing and has made friends with dancers from all over the world. He also enjoys the travel involved in competing, which in September has taken him to Edinburgh, Belfast, Surrey, Kent and Dublin. He would love to be in a show like Riverdance in the future and would one day like to become a dance teacher himself.
12 Dorset churches have been given grants for essential repairs and improvements by Dorset Historic Churches Trust. At the first trustee meeting of the year, a total of £55,250 was awarded primarily towards roof masonry and bell tower repairs, heating replacement and the installation of accessible toilets. Churches that will benefit from the latest grants are in the Blackmore Vale area, and they include St Thomas a Becket, Lind Lynch, St Cuthbert Oborne, St Mary the Virgin Sherburne, St Giles Hook, Holyrood Shillingston, St Mary Turnworth, St Mary and Cuthberger, and All Saints at Witchampton.
More than 50 villagers from Maiden Newton formed a human chain around the village fire station as they continue to campaign to keep the station open as it faces the threat of closure. It's the latest stunt from the Maiden Newton Action Group to help save the Under Threat station, following a demonstration which saw members chain themselves to a fire engine in Dorchester in April. The station is one of four Dorset stations put forward for closure as Dorset and Wiltshire Fire and Rescue Service look to cut costs amid a lack of government funding. The other stations under threat include Charmouth, Cranbourne and Hanworthy. Villagers also composed and sang a song for their protest to the tune of London's Burning. They chanted, "Dorset's burning, Dorset's burning, there's no engine, there's no engine, fire, 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 we're in danger, we're in danger." There are also family events included face painting with images of flames, music and a bubble machine. The action group plans to organise a final event on the 11th of June, just a couple of weeks before the fire authority makes its final decision on the 30th of June. In a reenactment from the past, villagers will form a line to pass buckets from the river to a cottage that was previously saved from fire by the local fire station.
A long-established Wimborne firearms shop is set to close its doors for the final time, marking the end of an era for both its owner and the town's independent retail scene. John Marsh, owner of Firearms Limited in West Street, has announced he will be retiring at the age of 84 after running the specialist business for 49 years. While retirement played a major role in the decision, Mr. Marsh said trading traditional conditions over the past 18 months have also contributed to the closure. "It doesn't feel good at all," he said. "I would rather be carrying on, but I'm 84, so I've had to retire." Speaking about the time of running the business, Mr. Marsh said the greatest reward was not necessarily the sales, but the people he met along the way. Reflecting on Wimborne's changing high street, he expressed concern about the decline of independent businesses and the impact it was having on the town's character. "They lose part of the character of the town," he said. "When I moved to Dorset in 1976, there were lots of small shops. Now it's full of hairdressers, estate agents and coffee shops, which I do not think encourages people to come into the town." The announcement has prompted an emotional response from many customers, several of whom have visited the shop in recent days to share their appreciation. "Everybody has come into the shop this week and said how sorry they are to see me going. What a shame it is, and wish it wasn't happening." As he prepares to lock the doors for the final time, Mr. Marsh admitted the decision had been a difficult one. He said, "Really just sad. Incredibly sad to be doing it. But thank you to all my customers over the years. God knows what I'm going to do when the shop closes, but there we go."
Margaret Barton, the last surviving star of classic British film Brief Encounter, has celebrated her 100th birthday. Margaret played cafe assistant Beryl Winters in the beloved 1945 film. She enjoyed her birthday milestone at the Streets Meadow Care Home in Wimborne, where she has been living for the last 3 years. The film premiered in London on November the 13th, 1945, and is widely considered to be one of the greatest films of all time. The birthday celebration included a visit from Wimborne Town Mayor, Councillor Jeff Hart, and a card from the King and Queen, which Miss Barton spent much time studying. A birthday cake shaped into the number 100 was specially made by Streets Meadow chefs, and Brief Encounter played in the background throughout the event.
Young people in Wimborne are being invited to step up and have their voices heard. The Junior Mayor and Junior Town Crier competition will be held at Wimborne Model Town and Gardens on Saturday the 4th of July. Starting at 2 p.m, the event aims to engage young people in civic life and help them develop public speaking skills and confidence. Councillor Jeff Hart, Town Mayor, said, "The Junior Mayor and Junior Town Crier competitions are a wonderful way to encourage young people to become involved in their community. We're looking forward to hearing some fantastic ideas and seeing the next generation of civic ambassadors take to the stage. The junior town crier category is open to children aged 6 to 14 who will be given a prepared town cry and judged on delivery, enthusiasm, clarity and volume. The junior mayor competition is open to those aged 9 to 18. Participants will prepare a speech on the topic, My Ideas to Make Wimborne Minster an Even Better Place.
A children's hospice has announced plans for a new head office. Julia's House will soon be operating from a fully refurbished space in East Street in Wimborne. The move follows a collaboration with Meissen Properties, First Floor Mezzanine and Jade Aden Interiors. The renovation includes a bespoke mezzanine floor and a complete internal fit-out, with the project expected to be completed by the beginning of July. Martin Edwards, CEO of Julia's House, said, We're so excited to be moving into our new head office building over the next couple of months and are very grateful to Meissen Properties and Jade Aden Interiors. Paul and his team for their generous gift in kind in terms of refurbishment and rental, which has helped us to make the move a reality. The new office will bring together all teams, including those in care, fundraising, communications, HR and operations. Mr. Edwards said, Being under one roof, including our care team, will bring us all closer together, enabling better sharing of information and ultimately enhance the vital care we provide. Probably the greatest cycle race in the world is the Tour de France, which takes place annually in July. So part of a piece of music with that name, created by the German group Kraftwerk, opens the news from Poole and Purbeck.
Poole Town Council wants to be able to keep the mayoral section of its civic centre. The Grade 2 listed former borough of Poole headquarters has remained empty since 2022, and ceased to function as a civic centre following the formation of BCP Council in 2019. Poole Civic Centre is currently being sold to MCR Current Property Group for an expected £5.25 million, following the proposal being approved at a vote by BCP Council. BCP councillors voted 33-21 in favour of accepting the offer from the Manchester-based developer, with two abstentions. Councillors rejected an amendment to delay the sale until October, with the motion failing by 28 votes to 24. The local authority anticipates annual savings of £228,000 from the transaction, with the wider development of the site is set to support BCP Council's housing targets. The decision includes entering discussions with the Town Council regarding lease terms for the retained a section of the building known as the vertical slice. This is an area spanning four floors and includes the Mayor's Parlour, the Cadiscock Room and the Council Chamber. Poole Town Council is looking at options to retain the vertical slice, where they could potentially host meetings and events.
A model railway society in Dorset is celebrating its 70th anniversary. The Poole and District Model Railway Society, originally formed as the Bournemouth Model Railway Society in August 1956. The society was formed to support individual modellers and create model railway layouts for exhibitions. In 1957, they used the waiting room of Bournemouth West Station as a club room. The society later moved to the old parcels office at Branksome Station in Poole. but due to space constraints, they relocated to an old BR Signalling Department building on Sturt Road in December 1962. Following the pandemic, the group held meetings in various locations until February 2023, when they settled into a room at the Old Boys Motorcycle Workshop in Pokestown. But a leasing issue forced another move, and since July 2024, the society has been based on Lagland Street, just off Poole High Street.
Automatic number plate recognition cameras are to be installed at Shell Bay in Studland, as payment for the Sandbanks ferry moves completely online. The toll booths in Shell Bay will no longer be manned from Wednesday the 1st of July, once the new website-based system takes over payment duties from a dozen part-time staff. In future, motorists leaving or arriving at Shell Bay will have their number plates recorded and can be expected to settle the payment online before midnight on the following day, with fines of nearly £30 on top of the crossing payment for those who don't. Paper tickets themselves will no longer be accepted on crossings from the 1st of July, but they can be taken to the ferry office in Studland and exchanged for tokens at any time until the end of May 2027. Cash payments were stopped by the ferry company in April 2026, and cyclists and foot passengers are expected to pay by card while on the ferry. Ferry prices will remain unchanged at £1.18 for pedestrians, bikes and motorbikes, £6.26 for cars and vans, and £12.52 for buses and coaches. The new system means that barriers at the toll booths will be removed and there will be no need for vehicles to stop. Ferry crossing payments in person by card, paper ticket or by Sandbanks ferry toll card will no longer be possible. Account holders will need to set up a new account from Wednesday the 1st of July, as their passes will then expire. Although tokens bought without an account will expire within 30 days, tokens bought through an account will be valid for 2 years. Ferry customers will eventually be able to set up new accounts via the Sandbanks Ferry website, and although the system is not yet live, the company claims it will be a quick and simple process.
18-year-old Millie Johnson from Poole has been elected to serve as Vice Chair of Youth Council UK. This is the first ever executive board representing young people across the UK, Crown dependencies and overseas territories. Millie is one of 19 young people aged 16 to 25 chosen to lead the newly formed board of Youth Council UK, YCUK. Priorities include voice and influence with decision makers at local, regional and national levels, connection and collaboration across the youth sector to share learning and coordinate action, and a platform that builds from local voices and grassroots change to create national influence. The board will serve a 2-year term with the next election scheduled for 2028.
In its first week of operation, the Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance's new £10 million helicopter was called out to Swanage after a local resident needed urgent emergency help. The new helicopter, as yet unnamed, arrived at the charity's operational base at Henstridge Airfield in North Dorset on Tuesday the 26th of May and is now working alongside Peggy, the much-loved 10-year-old original air ambulance. Only a short time into its new duties, the new air ambulance was spotted landing at King George's Playing Fields in the centre of Swanage on the 2nd of June. The helicopter was scrambled after a Swanage resident needed immediate treatment at home after a medical emergency. Swanage firefighters met the air ambulance paramedics on arrival and provided transport to the incident. To recognise the huge community fundraising effort in raising the final £1 million to buy and equip the new helicopter, the public is being given a chance to name her. With two helicopters, the air ambulance expects to reach over 150 more patients every year. The news is particularly significant for communities in Purbeck, where distances, rural roads and coastal locations can make rapid access to specialist medical care more challenging. Charles Hackett, Chief Executive of Dorset and Somerset's Air Ambulance, said, "Seeing the helicopter arrive at Henstridge was a proud and emotional moment and marked a major step forward in our ability to reach even more patients when they need us most."
A petition has been started urging BCP Council to replace outdated lifts in the car parks of Poole Dolphin Centre. The lifts at the Dolphin Centre car parks in Poole have been out of service since April and continue to break down even after repairs. BCP has acknowledged the issue and is starting and stated it is exploring long-term solutions. The shopping centre started a petition on change.org urging BCP Council to fix the lifts for good by fully replacing the lift systems to ensure safe and equal access for everyone. The Dolphin Centre said, "Our community is at the heart of everything we do, and we take pride in listening to their thoughts and making sure everyone can enjoy the facilities that our town offers. Sadly, without operational lifts at the Dolphin Centre car parks, key demographics, including individuals with disability and parents with buggies, find it challenging or impossible to access the town centre. It is distressing for many residents and visitors, and we strongly believe it is time for change. This is not only a matter of convenience, but one of equality and respect for all."
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle.
Our section of What's On today starts with part of Bicycle Race by Queen. The Wimborne Minster Folk Festival 2026 is taking place from the 12th to the 14th of June, featuring music, dance, workshops, family activities and street markets. The Wimborne Minster Folk Festival is a long-standing volunteer-run event, celebrating folk music, dance and community spirit in the historic market town of Wimborne Minster. Established in 1981, it has grown into one of the South of England's premier folk gatherings, blending traditional performances with family-friendly activities, art exhibitions, local food and drink offerings. The festival emphasises accessibility and community engagement with many free outdoor events and interactive workshops.
Choral Masterpieces will take centre stage at a historic Dorset venue as part of a special musical evening. The Bournemouth Bach Choir will perform its final concert of the season at Romsey Abbey on Saturday, June the 13th, in a programme titled Heavenly Harmony. The concert will feature George Frederick Handel's coronation anthems, including Zadok the Priest and J.S. Bach's Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. The venue adds historical significance to the performance, as Romsey Abbey is the burial place of Admiral of the Fleet Louis Mountbatten, 1st Earl Mountbatten of Burma. Lord Mountbatten played a prominent role in the royal family, serving as a mentor to King Charles III. Handel's coronation anthems were composed for the 1727 coronation of George II and have been performed at every British coronation since.
This July, the jagged silhouette of Corfe Castle will serve as more than just an historic landmark. It becomes a canvas for light and sound. Summer nights at the castle brings the prestigious Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra to the heart of the Purbecks for a three-night performance between the 24th and the 26th of July that blends centuries of history with world-class music. As the sun sets over the ruins, the stone walls come alive with a bespoke light show synchronised to the music. It's an invitation to pack a picnic, spread out a blanket and lose yourself in an atmosphere of open-air experience that feels both grand and intimate. The doors open each evening at 6:30 for a 7 p.m. start. Tickets are £40 each.
And earlier in the month, Corfe Castle will be holding a food and drink festival. This is from the 11th to the 12th of July. The best locally produced food and drink in Purbeck and South Dorset area.
A three-day festival promises a packed weekend of live music, street food and family fun in Dorset next weekend. Upton House Food and Music Festival returns to Upton Country Park in Poole from June the 12th to the 14th with a vibrant mix of tribute acts, DJs and international cuisine.
A Bournemouth park is gearing up for an evening of music and magic as Proms in the Park returns this summer, filling the night sky with a symphony under the stars. The Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra will return to Merrick Park for two open-air concerts on Friday, August the 7th and Saturday, August the 8th, as part of its popular BSO Pop series. Throughout the weekend, the musical lineup will feature two distinct themes: movie classics on the Friday, closely followed by 1990s chart toppers on the Saturday, all to be rounded off with a fireworks display.
Up until this year, ITV4 televised, free to air, the vast majority of the annual Tour de France bicycle race, which of course included some wonderful shots of the French cities, towns, villages and countryside. So for our sports section, we open it with part of the theme music, which was used to accompany their superb coverage. A young woman who survived a near-fatal car crash is now breaking down boundaries in women's cricket. Charlotte Mandale, 26, has become the youngest ever female chair of a recreational cricket club. This was in 1922 when she took the reins of Puddletown Cricket Club, but her journey was not easy. At 17, she was in a crash that almost took her life, and the doctors told the promising young cricketer she would never walk again, let alone play the game she'd fallen in love with. "I broke my back in five places, I broke my wrist, I severed all the nerves in my right knee, so I spent, as I'm sure you can imagine, quite a lengthy period of time in hospital," Charlotte explained. After a long spell in hospital, she began intensive rehab with her physio in Life Health in Westbourne, where she now works, and she learnt to walk again. Now, almost a decade on, Charlotte, who lives near Blandford, is inspiring women and girls across the Dorset cricket community, leading an all-female committee and shaking off the social norms that cricket is a man's game. She's pleased to see how the game has become more accessible to women and girls across Dorset since she started playing as a child. Looking at her role at Puddletown, Charlotte also wants to create an environment where people from all walks of life can enjoy themselves, but admits she does get competitive on match days. "As chair, my main hope is for everyone that they can turn up and enjoy the cricket. I don't mind if they win or lose as long as though they've enjoyed it." Her work has not gone unnoticed on the national stage either. She has been selected as one of 53 women being recognised by the ECB's Raising the Game Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Drive, created to spotlight women changing cricket at every level during the ICC Women's T20 World Cup, which is being held in England at the moment. She added, "Yes, we have all these incredible elite players, but there are so many ways of being involved in a cricket club by just playing."
The Glenmore Girls under-15s football team celebrated a 3-1 victory against St Joseph's RC Academy. The match took place on May the 21st at the Bet365 Stadium, with Glenmore making history as the first team from Glenmore and Winton Academies to win a national final. About 100 staff, students and parents travelled from Bournemouth to Stoke to support the team. The squad are all part of the Glenmore Football Academy and have attributed their success to years of hard work, dedication and commitment.
Marco Rose has confirmed the staff that will come with him to the Cherries as the German becomes the club's new head coach this summer. The new boss is set to bring with him three staff members, with the club progressing with contracts and visas for the trio. Rose, in his first interview with AFCB TV, confirmed who would be joining the club alongside him. There are two assistant coaches, Marco, like me, Marco Kurth and Frank Gerdeck, he said. I met them in Leipzig, or Frank in Mönchengladbach. I'll bring an analysis guy with me, but for me it's very important that everyone knows here that, again, we don't come to explain something. We come here to work together. So, for me it's very important that we get very soon the perfect team who is working together in the same direction with a high energy. And that's what we try to do. Rose said he likes to be hands-on with coaching. For me, he said, the best place to be as a coach is on the pitch, not stuck in the office. I love to be on the pitch, and I'm an intensive coach, sometimes a little bit over it, but I try to be always fair, and it's about the players. It's a players' game, so yeah, we need to build a connection with them all.
Chris Billam-Smith defeated Ryan Riziki by technical knockout in a brutal fight in front of a bouncing home crowd at Bournemouth International Centre. Riziki's corner retired the Canadian after the seventh, after a huge battle between the two. It was a performance where CBS's quality shone through as Riziki sought to pile on the intensity and he looked for an early stoppage. The two fighters looked drained of energy even early on, but CBS found his target more often than his opponent and gained the upper hand. The sixth round saw CBS land a flurry of punches, and that seemed to get him the upper hand that he never relinquished. Another brutal round in the seventh saw Riziki land some blows of his own, but he continued to take hits, and eventually his corner threw in the towel.
The Cherries are in the process of appealing after their application for Category 1 academic status was turned down. Category 1 academies give clubs across access to the top young talent in the country, with the additional funding and top-level facilities giving players the best resources to progress. An audit was carried out by the Professional Game Academy Audit Company earlier this year, and it is understood that the refusal was down to a lack of pitches at the club's new performance centre. The performance centre opened last year, with designs of progressing to a top-level academy with the construction of the dome, along with a host of other facilities. Category 1 clubs also need to have minimum budgets, as well as highly qualified staff and education programmes for the players.
I must admit that I let out a gasp when I heard that Andoni Iraola will become Liverpool's new head coach this week, after agreeing to succeed Arne Slot. Negotiations with Iraola have been led by the club's sporting director, Richard Hughes, who was responsible for bringing the Basque to the Premier League when appointing him at Bournemouth 3 years ago. Iraola is set to sign a 2-year deal, which aligns with the short-term contracts he had previously penned during his coaching career. The 43-year-old has been identified as the coach who will deliver the front-foot intense football that Liverpool now favour, after the decision to sack Slot last Saturday, just a year after he won the title in his first season in charge. Crystal Palace, AC Milan and Bayer Leverkusen had all been speaking with Iraola in an attempt to persuade him to take the next step of his career, but the lure of Liverpool won out. Iraola is expected to want to bring his assistant Tommy Elphick, a lifelong Liverpool fan, with him, as well as Pablo de la Torre, Sean Cooper and Tom Webber.
Poole Pirates have confirmed the dates for their Cup semi-final against Berwick. Poole will host the first leg of the tie on Wednesday, June the 24th, before they travel to Northumberland for the deciding leg the following Saturday, June the 27th. The second leg was due to be the day when Poole would head to face the Bandits in the league, but that match will now be rearranged with a date to be confirmed. Pirates are the defending cup holders after their victory over the Redcar Bears last season in the final, with Richard Lawson and Zach Cook starring in the final. The home leg of the semi-final will be the first meeting between Poole and Berwick this season.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your arms adore. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage, I can't afford a carriage, but you'll look sweet on the seat of a bicycle bill for two.
A firm favourite, first composed by Harry Dacre in 1892, part of Daisy Bell, with the subtitle Bicycle Built for Two, and sung here by Gerald Adams and the Variety Singers, opens our Serendipity section. In Serendipity today, we have a few miscellaneous articles for you. You may never have heard of Sir John and Lady Jean Wilson, but to many living in parts of Africa, they were life changers. You see, Sir John was blind and worked for the National Institute of the Blind, and in the late 1940s was sent to Ghana by the Colonial Office to assess how the blind were being treated. He discovered they were treated as pariahs, seen as useless, another mouth to be fed, and that was all. His wife Jean accompanied him, and she was his eyes, describing everything she saw and taking pictures with her camera.
So ingrained was the villagers' belief that blindness was a biological inevitability that Jean was viewed with fascination and wonder. She was the extraordinary one there, said John, because they believed that most of the world was blind, and here was Jean in her late 20s, and she could see. She was some sort of monster, and she had this strange thing called a camera. The photographs Jean took would be used in the couple's campaign to eradicate a disease called onchocerciasis that leads to permanent blindness and was caused by Black River flies.
Jean quickly realised that such a forbidding name would not capture the public's imagination, so she suggested river blindness as an easier name for this deadly disease. On their return to Britain, the Wilsons set about raising £40,000 to start their campaign and to send out two doctors to begin a programme of treatment and prevention. They gradually discovered that the problem was much more widespread, and surveys they conducted in East, West and Central Africa showed how rife issues such as trachomas, cataracts and nutritional blindness were. So they extended their campaign to tackle preventable blindness in Africa. Trachoma is a particularly painful, highly contagious eye disease, causing chronic conjunctivitis and eyelid scarring. The eyelashes also grow inwards into the eye, and if untreated, this causes corneal damage and eventually blindness.
Within a year, they'd received royal assent, formed national organisations in six countries, and become leading players in the global struggle to eliminate preventable blindness. They set up training centres to teach blind men to farm, and started an integrated education project for blind children in Uganda, after Jean had visited schools in America, where blind and disabled children were integrated into normal schools, unlike in Britain. In 1986, their organisation gained the name, which by which most people know it today, Sight Savers.
John met Jean when he came to her house as a lodger, and they married in 1944. Jean was John's rock. She has compensated for any shortcomings my blindness could have caused, said John, although he always referred to his disability as nothing more than a confounded nuisance. and never saw the accident that made him blind as tragic. It happened during a chemistry experiment at Scarborough High School for boys when John was 12. He was putting the blue flame from the Bunsen burner onto the test tube when it exploded. The chemicals had been wrongly labelled and it produced an explosive mixture. Bottles shattered and many of the pupils were showered with glass. One was blinded in one eye, but John was blinded in both.
When John joined the National Institute for the Blind, it was still stuck, he said, in a Victorian attitude to the blind. They were treated like charity cases, hidden away in workshops and given basket weaving or mattress stuffing jobs. The combination of fear, pity and discomfort were things John and Jean would try to combat in Africa. Sightsavers is still one of the leading blindness charities. It operates in more than 30 countries and in 2017 celebrated its billionth treatment for tropical diseases. To achieve this, the Wilsons travelled 50,000 miles a year for half a century. It was always a shared effort.
Sir John was knighted for his services to the blind in 1975 and Jean was appointed an OBE in the 1980s. John died in 1999 and Jean's death was announced in January this year and she was 103. Sightsavers issued a statement on her death, saying that she will be hugely missed and praising her incredible legacy, which they are proud to continue. Both Egypt and Senegal have now officially eliminated trachoma, that painful blinding disease which has affected communities for generations.
Miller's tale carries on with protege, aged 77. There has been a mill on the banks of the River Stour of Sturminster Newton since before the Norman Conquest. But finding a young apprentice able to continue its legacy has proved a grind. Peter Loosemore, aged 85, a master miller, has looked after the building in Dorset since 1994, bringing the water-powered milling machines back into action, but has struggled to find a younger person to take over the job. After a couple of candidates in their 40s and 50s failed to make the grade, Loosemore has finally found his young protégé, 77-year-old Ray Hall, a retired Royal Navy engineer. Hall, who sold aircraft parts and ran a corner shop after leaving the Navy, said he'd been looking for projects to keep him busy since the death of Beverly, his wife of 48 years, in 2018. Loosemore, whose grandfather began working at the mill aged 14 in 1894, said it was difficult to find an apprentice because young people were put off by the hard work and low pay. He said a couple of candidates in their 40s and 50s had shown an interest, but it did not work out because they lacked the enthusiasm for it. Ray is learning how to start and stop the mill, make adjustments to the machinery, and the role also involves cleansing, manning the shop, and doing guided tours. Hall, who served in the Falklands War on HMS Invincible, spends 4 days a week learning from his veteran boss. Sturminster Newton Mill is one of several ancient flour mills on the Stour recorded in Domesday Book, which was compiled in 1086. It is thought there may have been a mill on the site in Saxon times. The machinery runs every day. The mill is open and flour is produced on the second weekend of each month to be sold in the mill and museum shops.
Moving westwards from Sturminster Newton, we arrive at the Cerne Abbas Giant. For more than a century, those looking after the giant have carried out the same back-breaking ritual every decade to maintain its white outline. Using pickaxes, National Trust staff and volunteers dig up every centimetre of the 460-metre outline before packing 17 tonnes of fresh chalk into the hillside colossus. However, warmer winters and wetter summers are causing algae growth to dull the figure's outline much more quickly. Luke Dawson, lead ranger for the Trust at West Dorset and Cranbourne Chase, said, "We are seeing more intense rainfall, which can increase water runoff and gradually wear away the chalk. So we're planning further monitoring to understand the impacts and how we might need to adopt, potentially by rechalking more often." Dawson was 4 days into a gruelling 14-day rechalking effort, the first since 2019. The Trust is always trialling a new method to make the work easier on the rangers, specialists and trained volunteers. Instead of battering fresh hard chalk back into the cuttings, this year they're combining chalk powder and water in a cement mixture to create a putty plaster they can squidge into the outlines and allow to bake hard. Because it only happens every 7 to 10 years, there's a lot of excitement, Dawson said. If we have to do this rechalking more frequently, we might struggle to recruit volunteers. The Trust has 60 volunteers working in two shifts each day, but some have dropped out during the heatwave. Dawson said it was tough graft, adding, "You have the hill to contend with, sloping at around 1 in 3, and once you have spades in the ground, it's not easy going. But it's not something we can shy away from. At 180 feet tall, the naked, club-wielding giant is Britain's largest chalk hill figure, dominating the view above Cerne Abbas. In 2021, the Trust commissioned analysis which revealed that the giant was probably carved in the late Saxon period, between 700 and 1100 AD. Research by the University of Oxford suggested he was carved as an image of Hercules and could have marked a muster station for West Saxon armies.
We open our magazine section with part of Cycling is Fun by the Japanese pop band Shonen Knife. We close with part of Les Bicyclettes Del Bel Sais, sung here by Engelbert Humperdinck. For our magazine today, we have an article taken from the Dorset magazine entitled Living History, all about Athelhampton House. Buying a Tudor house with a minstrel's gallery might not be everybody's retirement dream, but for Giles Keating, it was very much so. So when Athelhampton House, 7 miles east of Dorchester, came up for sale, he could hardly believe his luck. "I think it's the romance," he said, seated in the 16th century library. "What I wanted was somewhere that really captured the joy and exuberance of the Elizabethan era, the music and the drama. And I think a minstrel's gallery brings all that together." Giles was born in London, where regular family commitments mean he still spends much of his time. "So like most people, however, I came to Dorset a lot as a child. I love walks in the countryside and being close to the sea. It's a wonderful county."
His training as an economist led to a highly successful career in banking. And alongside a fellowship at Oxford University, he has written books and articles on economic forecasting. The sort of thing that Rachel Reeves and her colleagues are busy doing. None of which would seem to foreshadow his current role as the custodian of an ancient estate. Yes, they're completely different jobs that bring different kinds of pleasure, he says. "But let's be blunt here, you're at the hard end of business. In a way, I feel quite humble when I look back to when I was an economist, making great pronouncements about where the economy was going. Now there are so many different elements to consider, but it's a wonderful place to be. We see lovely visitors every day and it's such a great adventure."
Many of the Athelhampton staff have worked at the house for decades, something that Giles doesn't underestimate. "I was incredibly lucky that there was a fabulous team already in place. We work very much as a partnership. Among them is Owen Davies, his right-hand man for the past 27 years, and Emma Park, who has worked at Athelhampton for 22 years. It's part of Dorset life, and I'm Dorset-born, says Emma. How many people can say they work in a 500-year-old house just a short walk from their home? The main part of Athelhampton, including its Great Hall, was built in the late 1400s by Sir William Martin at the start of the Tudor era. When I ask about its history, Giles enthusiastically whips through the centuries, reeling off illustrious names, Civil War plots whispered on staircases, and the period when the house was divided between four owners before, in the 1800s, becoming a farmhouse.
Today, Athelhampton comprises about 25 acres and includes a cafe and tiny cinema, two holiday homes, a cottage next to the River Piddle, and the Cochrane wing of the main house, and extensive, beautifully kept Elizabethan-style gardens. Giles bought the business in 2019, and one of the conditions of the sale was that all the furniture in the house had to be sold separately. As a result, he and his team had to refurnish it completely, a process that took 5 months. It was extraordinary, starting from a virtually zero knowledge base. We hired an excellent consultant who helped us create a buying strategy whereby each room would correspond to one of the house's different eras. So here in the library, we're clearly in the Victorian era, and we have a couple of unequivocal Tudor bedrooms. One of the most popular rooms is a bedroom full of 1930s furniture. For some people, this would have been a shopping nirvana, but I just wanted to get it done, and we had to do it fast because we needed to open the house again.
Since then, work has been carried out on the building itself, including restoring the Elizabethan kitchen. It was quite exciting in a way because we found a bread oven hidden behind a dishwasher, smiles Giles, and we removed the arger to open up the original working fireplace. Given the beauty of the house and gardens, I'm surprised it hasn't been used more often as a film location, something that Giles and the team are keen to encourage. There was Sleuth, starring Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier, and the Seeds of Doom series of Doctor Who, which was filmed here, as well as From Time to Time, directed by a wonderful neighbour, Julian Fellowes. And the house was the first to feature in TV's Most Haunted. There's talk of a grey lady walking the corridors and an ape who was trapped behind the panelling. A murder also took place here, apparently.
Personally, I've always found Athelhampton to be an exceptionally happy place. Even when I'm here on my own, I've always felt it feels very friendly. Perhaps it's indicative of how wonderfully it's been looked after by all who've lived here, each in their own different ways. One thing that helps with the atmosphere is how warm the house is, something you really notice on a chilly afternoon. Increasing the house's environmental credentials was something I prioritised, says Giles, who worked on site with architects Space, renowned for blending heritage conservation with cutting-edge sustainability. The house was full of inefficient gas boilers that kept breaking down. Now we have ground source heating for the coach house and cottage, and air source pumps for the main building. It was a huge job, which has worked amazingly well. The car park also has plenty of car charging stations, and there's solar information board outside the coach house.
Another thing that has kept Giles busy since he arrived is his writing, now adding fiction to his oeuvre, inspired by Athelhampton. Since 2020, he has written a trilogy, Anne of Athelhampton, based on the Martin sisters who lived in the house during the Elizabethan period. It almost felt like cheating in a sense that there's so much history within the house and not just involving kings and queens, but individuals who once lived here, explains Giles. There's an incredible story of an unpleasant man trying to steal from his grandmother, a young girl and her pet ape brought back from Africa by a pirate, and four young heiresses who owned the house and whom everybody wanted to marry.
The book's covers were designed by local artist Noah Warnes, and although they appear to be aimed at children, Giles knows it is mostly adults who read them. Which I can understand, as they actually contain some quite deep themes, he says. Giles has also recently produced a book, Thomas Hardy, 10 Lovers and 50 Poems, which is the culmination of about 18 months' work. This includes extensive research into the lovers' individual backgrounds, collaboration with local theatre companies, including the Hardy Players and Dorchester Youth Theatre, and interviews with Hardy aficionados. In the book, each poem is followed by a discussion of its origins, while a QR code links to a film with actors acting out the poem, followed by interviews with experts such as Mark Chutter, chair of the Thomas Hardy Society.
Everyone puts such an incredible effort into the videos, Giles explains. Hardy spent a lot of time at Athelhampton. He was even dining here when the First World War was declared. The idea is to bring him to a wider audience by presenting his poems in a more accessible form. There's also some exciting new research. Hardy was engaged to a young lady called Eliza Nichols, who's generally been written off as one of life's failures. However, my primary research uncovered that in her will she left a small fortune when she died, which she seems to have earned through her own devices, putting her in a very different light. I love primary research, explains Giles. It's something that goes back to my days as an economist. You always go back to the original sources and the numbers.
Thanks to Giles and his team, the numbers at Athelhampton continue to look exceptionally healthy, including cruise ship coast tours. I think it's partly because there are now twice as many rooms to see, reflects Giles, and a visit here can be a whole day out if you want it. You can start with our history films in the coach house, where you can also get a coffee or lunch, then walk the gardens and the house, discovering the ghosts in the cellar, as well as regularly changing art exhibitions on the top floor. So, is owning a Tudor house with a minstrel's gallery everything he hoped it would be? I guess a bit of energy is required, and there's an enormous sense of responsibility. What I hope to be able to do is both preserve and very gently enhance the house for the future. There's still so much detail of its history to discover, and I find all that quite thrilling. Athelhampton House is open throughout the year. Research athelhampton.com.
Let me say when the bell sighs, carry a sigh.
We've now come to the end of our recording for today, and we do hope you've enjoyed pedalling along to John's bicycle music. We always look forward to hearing from you with any suggestions you may have, so here is our number again, 07587 174 297. Alison, Peter and John all join me in sending our very best wishes, and we will be with you again on June the 24th.